Hello, Rachel.
Hello, Ryan.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing very well, I guess. I've got a lot of thoughts. I've got a lot of gears moving around. But Rachel, I guess the real question is, what do you want? What do you want, Rachel?
I want for us to make a good episode.
Yeah. Oh, I want to know who in this episode would have said yum yum if this was written by the Star Trek Discovery writers, where the iconic line yum yum came from. Who in this story was the yum yum deliverer?
Morden.
You think it was Morden?
I think it was Morden.
Yeah, I think it was Morden too. He has a very cheeky energy to him. And I want to just put this here now. We are going to strive in the future not to just say it's Morden every time he's in an episode. Yet he will always deliver yum yum energy, or as we call it, YYE, on the podcast. So I'm Ryan. That's yum yum energy, YYE.
No, that's not a thing.
Yes, it is. Yum Yum Energy.
Stop trying to make fetch a thing.
So, I'm Ryan, that's Rachel. We're the Yum Yum Podcast, because the iconic line of dialogue from Star Trek Discovery, and we are rewatching Babylon 5. We're talking about Babylon 5, and yes, rewatching. So, if you have not seen the show, well, we recommend that you watch the entire show, especially if you're trying to listen to this particular episode's discussion, because this is an episode of Babylon 5 in which it's completely recontextualized when you've watched the show and you've come back. So that does mean we're spoiling Babylon 5 as we talk about it. But Rachel, what episode of Babylon 5 are we chin-wagging about for this one?
We are up to Signs and Portents, which is episode 13 of the first season. The DVD brochure with its lovely synopses and extra little details offers us this particular description.
Yes.
Mysterious raider attacks in various star grids puts Babylon 5 on alert and sends Ivanova and Fight Wing Delta scrambling into action.
Yeah, that's the main plot.
Adding to the mystery, the arrival of Sia. Freddie Olster.
Yeah, that's the actress.
Who foretells explosive doom for the station?
She does. Oh, no Morden mention.
Nah.
Oh, he's not even worth mentioning in this. No, mysterious man comes... Oh, wait, that's every plot, isn't it? Mysterious man comes to the ship. So, Signs and Portents. A very big episode that requires a very big discussion. Out of all of the episodes that we've had to talk about, this is the one that I felt the most pressure on, because this is the game changer episode. This is where stuff starts to change. The big story has now been introduced into the show, and this is the game changing episode.
They're here.
This is where we've turned a corner, and there's lots of stuff to talk about. So we're going to strive to do our best, but by God, this episode has a lot of stuff in it that it just feels daunting to even try to get it all in here, but we will at least strive to talk about it the best we can, because by Lord, Signs and Portents is such a big episode that it's the name of the first season, or it's like the episode that the season marks itself with. Like, this is the chapter of Signs and Portents, because it's that big of an episode. As every season will have that big episode in which they have it, the title of the season, this is the one on the red DVD case.
And this is called the break shot, as all the balls scatter in different directions, and you then deal each ball individually. This is called the break shot. And there's a break shot in this story that takes all of our characters and does the same thing with them. You'll know it when it happens.
Let's hear from you. What is your history and relationship with Signs and Portents?
I honestly can't remember the first time that I watched it, because it's so deeply changed by the rewatches that we've done. I find it really hard to think back and remember what it was like on that first viewing. And I was really trying to, like, I wonder, well, I was like, oh, it would have led me down this path and I would have thought this thing about that thing. And it just reminded me how frustrating I found Babylon 5 on the first watch, because I was like, what the fuck is happening?
Mm-hmm. And like, of course, what was the big frustration moment for you? Do you remember when you watched this?
Do you remember what it was for me?
I do, but I think you could kind of have a stab in the dark of what moment it is when you watch this episode. There's a big moment towards the end of the episode in which something happens that's explained but also completely unexplained.
No, I can't remember which one it is.
Oh, you don't remember how angry you were that I refused to tell you what that big ship spidery thing was? I cut that guy and that cut that ship in half and just disappeared, and I was just like, I don't know. We'll have to watch to find out, Rachel. And you were like fuming over it, and you're like, "Well, those are the
that's
shadows.
The big
What's a shadow? Like, what the fuck is that Morden? Is that what is that? Is it like a creature? Is it a ship?" And I was just sitting there going, "I don't know. I'm not gonna tell you. It's not like they're the big bad guys of the show or anything like that."
Mm-hmm. But one thing that you did tell me was, you do get answers.
Yes, that's the important thing to know is this isn't fucking, you know, J.J. Abrams production. This isn't like, you know, modern Star Trek either. You actually do get answers and ones that are coherent. So my history with this episode is, as everyone knows, if you've listened to the show before, and if you have not, welcome. You're going to hear some information that's new for old people listening. You're going to hear some old information. I had the season one on DVD by itself for several years, and I, of course, was obsessed.
Perhaps even decades at this stage.
Yeah, it was, you know, 10 years after the Earthman Barry War. So I had this for a very long time in isolation. This season, of course, this episode was the one that drew my attention. It's written on the DVD case. It's full of mysteries, and my history with it was I thought, no, they can't be doing this. They can't be doing this. How could they have done this? Because I was used to these type of turning points in a sci-fi story happening seasons into the show, because, again, to bang the old drum, having grown up with Star Trek, I was used to them taking their sweet-ass time to change up the pot like this, to stir it up. Like, Deep Space Nine takes a fucking while to even hint that the Dominion's going to be something of importance, let alone have them be something that is like, oh, we're going to be looking forward to that. You have Odo's existence, of course. He's, you know, a founder, I guess. You know, he's a changeling. But, you know, the thing is, you don't have an episode like this in Star Trek this early on, you know, in the way that you know actually matter. TNG's early days tried to do that with the Ferengi, and then they gave up because the Ferengi weren't as good as the Klingons, and then they minorly did stuff with the Romulans, but nothing like this. So my reaction was just bewilderment. I thought, whoa, you can't just start throwing this in here this early. I'm still getting to know the crew. How? Whoa, this is... I kept reacting to it like this is something you're not allowed to do. Because at this stage in television story, you know, like, in television's way of telling stories, it was unusual to start doing this. It was unusual to have a show that was already having several mysteries to then introduce more and new ones and throw them up in the air and expect the audience to just be patient. So that's my history, and my relationship with this episode is I love this episode. Of course I do. This episode is a reward when you rewatch it. This isn't one of those fucking episodes of Mystery Box TV bullshit in which you rewatch it and it's incomprehensible, or it all doesn't quite line up, or it is kind of bland on a rewatch. This is still exciting, this is still fun, and you get a lot of those, ooh, that was, oh, I didn't even think about that on the first watch, or that paid off in a way that you don't expect, oh, or mainly, oh, this is when Londo starts to dig his own grave.
You're really talking this episode up, Brian.
Yes, I am really talking this episode up, aren't I? But that has been my feelings on it. But you're sounding like we should actually start talking about the episode.
Yeah.
And I think to talk about the episode, to give it its fair dues, there's going to be lots to discuss. The foreshadowing, the character work, but let's do the thing in which we don't do often, which is let's front load the episode with the discussion points of what doesn't work.
Nonsense.
Rachel, what are some things that came out at you that you think didn't work or were bad or not as good?
No, it's odd because there's so much going on that you want to take out some of it or rejig it in some way because you just, like, it's just kind of off for me in some places.
A tad overstuffed,
but it's just like you need all of that stuff to be happening in the time around this stuff. Like, that's kind of a downfall of the depth of storytelling that they're going for in the like, if they could have just had like 5 extra minutes for this episode, it could have been a lot better because just some things needed more time to breathe.
Yeah. Any examples that you can think of that part that doesn't like line up or doesn't flow as well in this?
I like the idea, but the execution of this feels a bit off, which is when like we get set up for the Sinclair is explaining to Garibaldi what he's discovered. And then we cut away to the Centauri, right? And then we cut back to, like, the end of the conversation with Garibaldi and Sinclair. And I was like, wait, what?
Oh, I like that because it was a clever way of skipping exposition.
It was clever, but I was just like, oh, we're going back here. This doesn't...
Yeah, like, you felt like we, the, like, audience, know.
Yeah, we, the audience, know. And it was just that kind of detour where it felt very much like, okay, now we're switching tracks, going back to this, and we'll kind of lead into other stuff.
Yeah,
but not fully within this episode itself. Like, it's just the crumbs of something that's going to be paid off later.
And it's paying off something as well, which is, again, furthering the Sinclair mystery.
But it's just,
I agree,
like, with so many other things happening that are really important to the huge picture of Babylon 5 and
to the tapestry
the
of it
episode
all.
Itself that just dangles a bit loosely.
Yeah, I agree. I think you know the Sinclair side of the story, he's,
why are they in the bathroom?
No, I love that because Star Trek would never do that. And it's just,
no,
you know, talking while you're having a piss.
Very much more of a typical female thing to do, to have conversations in the bathroom. So I like it, and I like their hand wash dry
vibe. The vibe
of like the disinfecting UV rays.
Yeah, a nice little touch that Jerry Doyle did was I saw him look underneath his fingernail and start just like wiping it because it clearly didn't get there. Like, I just want to get that out myself. Yeah. And so that was a neat little actor's touch there. But
yeah, and it's a cute little detail, but it's also just like,
it's a scene that you're, okay, so I agree.
They built this set for this.
I love that set though. I agree. I think the Sinclair stuff, although important to the grand narrative, it does feel like it's shoved into an episode that's got so much stuff there. And the editing choice that you're talking about, like, it's a clever way of cutting away from exposition because we, the audience, already know this. And I am torn because I do like the scene where we cut back and they talk.
I like that it does that.
I like it, but it is again, adding a lot of stuff to an already jam-packed episode. If this was a lighter episode than that would be easier to swallow. But the conversation that they do have, although the strength of it is seeing their bond and their friendship, the weakness of it in the writing to me is it also exists to basically look at the audience and say, we are still following this through, and now we've expanded the picture a little bit more, and we may live to regret this. Basically looking at the camera and saying, this drama will continue, and there will be consequences. And that's okay, but I don't think it's 100% needed in this episode. It was great in other episodes, but in this one, yeah, at the very end, the information about the Minbari, choosing him, all of that's really good to know, and it's really fun to know, but the question is, did it need to be in this episode? Just like with Sinclair's PTSD triggering events in Infection, did that need to be in that episode? It's not as if we're saying, don't have these in the show. It's more, is it wise to place it in these type of episodes where you've got so many other angles to shoot for?
And Jeff, thanks for trusting me enough to bring me in on this.
Don't thank me until we figure out where this thing goes. We may both end up regretting this conversation.
I think you know what my least favorite part of this episode is. I said it in our Season 1, Episode 1 discussion. The Raiders are here to shoot stuff and to cause station-wide drama so that all the stories that are happening kind of have a little framing device around it. I hate the Raiders in Babylon 5. They aren't in the show enough, and yet they feel like yet it feels like when you watch this episode, it feels as if the series has been patting itself on the back that, see, we're paying off the Raiders that we've been really cleverly throwing in the show. They've appeared like twice, mainly in that first episode and a blink and you'll miss it B plot in Believers, in which we all agreed it was the worst aspect of that episode. So unnecessary. And the Raiders here are just to exist, to cause some shooty-shooty drama, and to be fodder for the big bad at the end, to show us how big and bad they are, because they single-handedly destroyed the semi-recurring villains of the show thus far. I've always hated the Raiders. They weren't interesting. They didn't really offer any sort of commentary that was of worth. The actual performers of the Raiders each time was always wooden and lacking, and they were just evil for evil's sake, and that can be fun and all, but again, they take up time. Even though they're gone now, they took up time, and it always felt like to me in this episode they were means to an end rather than something naturally put into the story. What do you think about the Raiders?
They suck. They're dull. They're perfunctory. And I agree with everything that you said as well.
Yeah, it's one of those things where on paper, like, you know, on his corkboard,
cool idea, yeah.
On his corkboard with all these, you know, pieces of yarn, this is an interesting idea, right? Seed into the show very early on that Raiders are the big bad of the show, because we don't know when we're first watching it that there's going to be an intergalactic threat that's a giant alien spider, right? We don't know that. We are introduced to this fairly grounded science fiction show. So the idea of Raiders being a villain makes sense, because that's a logical thing that would happen if we went to space. You would imagine there would be space criminals, there would be
space pirates.
There would be space pirates.
Space pirates!
Space pirates? You know, pirates, but in space!
And so having them as just a nibbling threat that eventually would attack the station makes sense when you think about it. But when you actually watch it, there was never enough legwork put into it to make this a satisfying payoff to this idea. You just look at it in this episode and go, oh, well, the Raiders are gone. The only enjoyment I get from the Raiders' existence is their destruction from an actual villain that's interesting. They themselves are not interesting. They only exist because they were needed in the script rather than actually, you know, they were needed with, you know, the quotation marks around it, you know, needed, but really they were just a writing device so that we, the audience, can go, these guys must be super bad because they just wiped out the bad guys in one foul swoop.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of, you know.
Yeah. Like, it definitely serves a purpose.
Anything else that stands out to you in this episode that doesn't work or just isn't the greatest to you? Any other bad aspects?
Nothing's leaping out to me, but what have you got?
Again, this is tied to the Raiders, but due to the structure of the episode and having so many pieces of focus, Lord Kiro as a character also feels like an object needed for the story rather than anything of interest or commentary. Sure, he's commenting upon Centauri politics, but we don't understand anything about that at this point.
Nah.
So we have little investment. But hey, that's okay. When you rewatch it, you do have investment. But he himself is not a character of interest. He is too dumb for me.
Mm.
Played well, but too dumb. Like, when the Raiders tell him that they're not going to abide by his plan because it's too unrealistic and stupid, I agreed. I'm like, yeah, you're stupid. And I know you could argue that's a part of Kiro's character. He's so arrogant and vain and, you know, self-righteous that he's to the point of stupidity. It's just not that interesting to watch because we don't spend enough time with him, and when we do, he is just explaining he's just dumping exposition on us. He's either telling us about Centauri politics, he's telling us about the theme of the episode for the Centauri side of it, or he's just telling us why he's going to be the betraying villain later in the episode. It never feels like there's a natural moment from Lord Kiro as a character. He, again, only feels like he's there so that you can have the guy, the first guy to get killed by the shadows in this show.
Mm.
You will forgive my aunt. She sometimes takes the role of prophetess too seriously.
Then you don't believe her vision?
She's been wrong before. On my first birthday, she said that someday I would be killed by the shadows.
Shadows?
Doesn't exactly make sense, does it?
He's also here because he is a, you know, a relative who's just going to dump more mysteries onto us or more foreshadowing events.
Yeah.
And she's also not interesting.
Oh, yeah. I was like, yeah, you wanted a message to be communicated and these characters serve that purpose.
Yeah. If the episode was a little stripped back and there was more time spent with them as the B plot or A plot, we may be more forgiving because we spend more time with these characters. But I got to ask you a question, Rachel. Her acting, was it good or was it actually bad? Or is it something that's a struggle with the type of role she has to play, which is, I'm having visions? What do you think?
I think it's all of the above. I think it's a little bit, she doesn't know where the line is exactly, and the nature of the part is quite hammy.
Mm-hmm.
And she does her best to try and sell it, but doesn't fully get there.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think she's good. And I think she's her performance is also brought down by production. One, she's got the bald cap on, or she's shaved head, whatever it is. And we have naturally accepted that as a part of the Centauri female side of the race. But when you have a character that's acting so terribly, like she is, or acting very over the top like she is, I do get a little bit of a chuckle watching her bald head shine. Because I don't care about her character enough to look past that. You know, I cared about Adira, so it didn't matter when Adira was a bald-headed lady with a ponytail. Because I liked Adira. I don't like this lady. And the other thing that I think production-wise that screws her over is my other big issue with this episode, overabundance of music. The music was so arrogantly used in this. It's great music. I love the music as it is, but I felt like this isn't a product of the 90s. But then I was going to say that, and then I realized Star Trek Discovery does this currently, so it's not a product of the 90s. It's just a product of lacking restraint. What did you think of that? Because I think it affected her performance quite a lot. She had a lot of overbearing music accompanying her.
Yeah, The music tries to do some pretty heavy lifting, and it just ends up feeling overwrought.
Yeah, it has some striking moments. Like, they play the theme song during the battle and it actually works quite well, but they have this...
A few too many stings.
I was going to say, they have this sting that I always associate with this episode for the Raiders, and I'll drop it in now. And they use that sting a lot in this episode, and it feels like a little too many times. Like, oh, I got it, guys. It's a sting. But yeah, I think her performance was dragged down from just, you know, the part being unnecessarily overwrought with without having any other aspect to her character. Her character is there just to freak out.
Yeah.
The makeup thing.
It's like, why did he even bring his aunt on this
voyage?
It's
a great question, isn't it? It's a great question. Because
that was the first thing that I thought. I was
like,
guess
she's
why?
The
why?
Elder relative and she's the quicker successor to the eye, I guess. Another aspect I've always scratched my head at, and I know the answer, but I don't think it works, is when Delenn has her meeting with Mr. Morden.
Yeah, like... What? Why that? That? Okay. I get it, but it doesn't work for me.
Well, do you want to explain it a bit? Just to give some context?
A brand appears on her forehead.
And then disappears.
And then disappears because it's like...
Her spidey sense.
Yeah.
I don't know. I know what it's supposed to be. I know it's supposed to be like... The Minbari being, you know, basically devout children of the Vorlons in a lot of ways have this genetic ability to sense shadows when they appear. And the triangle is a massive part of their culture. You know, the rule of threes, the three structure, three castes, even though at this point in the show they think it's only two castes because the writing wasn't consistent. Truly enough at this point. But, or you could argue, oh, they forgot about the workers. But the rule of threes, triangle, it's all important to the Minbari culture. But this is really the only time in which that ability is used.
Yep.
We see
it gets dropped just like those gravity rings.
We see them have it painted on when they're in the Grey Council, but that's different. That's like, oh, that's a part of, you know, the get up. That's a part of the cultural thing. But here,
and I was like, is this a special ability that she got because she is part of the Grey Council?
Or is it all Minbaris have this? And this is the only time I think it's actually ever used in this manner. And it's also just a bad effect.
Yeah.
You're transplanting an effect onto the person's face, and it just makes the scene, what's supposed to be scary, makes it always corny to me.
Yeah. I also don't buy the way that she says get out.
Oh, and also the cheesy writing of they're here.
Yeah.
That line could work if it wasn't basically repeated a few more times in the episodes from other characters stating, like, the shadows are here, the shadows are here. We get it. The writing in this episode sometimes with the foreshadowing stuff like that feels very hammered in. It just feels like it's beating you over the head and repeated a few too many times. Some of the execution of this stuff is cheesy. Some of the execution of this stuff is overwrought. But that's basically most of the, if not the bad stuff that I have to say about this episode.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like, it's a really great episode.
It's not deal-breaking bad.
No, it's not perfect. And what this episode does do positively is great, but it is also good to note that, you know, a season from now, two seasons from now, we'll get more episodes like this that are so much tighter.
Yeah.
You know, they're so much leaner, they're so much more fluid and natural. And that just says strengths about how this show evolved and changed and got better. It adapted. It grew.
Look, we're big. We're organized. But in no way are we big enough to help you knock over the Centauri government and put you in charge. I don't care how much leverage you think the Eye gives you. You think they're going to follow you just like that? Not a chance.
One of the things that does make it really good, though, I want to talk about some of the fun little moments that are spread throughout this episode. The moments that keep it light and fun, and you just have a smile on your face when you see it. And I want to talk about the battle sequences as well, because I want to lump those into with that general discussion. Rachel, do we want to talk about the very opening of the episode? Is it one of, if not the most iconic openings of Babylon 5?
Gotta love those ruffles. Ivanova's wearing a ruffly nightgown.
That's not what I pay attention to. I pay attention to a weird lamp or light, whatever that is on the symbol on it.
There's very particular choices that we're diverting. But it's a great opener. Ivanova struggling to wake up and getting frustrated with her
smart device computer.
Yeah.
Checking medical logs. forget it.
And that, but I love the like follow-up sequence of, it's not the sleeping that I have a problem with, it's the waking up.
Mm-hmm.
I have a problem waking up when it's dark outside. And he's like, it's always dark in space. He's like,
yes.
I know.
I have always loved this. It's a great Ivanova sequence of events. It's nice that in B5 you have these type of moments in which characters go to sleep and wake up and go to work and have showers and go to the toilet and read the newspaper and eat food and have drinks, because we have those in real life, but in TV shows, especially ones in these type of heightened genre environments, those things are often, you know, ejected from the story. Unless it's to flesh out exposition scenes, like in Enterprise. In Enterprise, a lot of scenes of them eating, drinking, or watching movies are just clever ways to make exposition flow easier than if you just had a guy stand there and speak about it all the time. Here, it's just funny. Like, the Ivanova thing, it's just funny. Like, why does my mouth taste like old carpet in the morning? Checking medical logs. And she's like, oh, God. Because the episode sets you up like, oh, this is going to be an Ivanova episode, because it opens on Ivanova. We never usually open with just Ivanova. Surely, no.
No.
Why isn't that annoying? Because usually that would be annoying,
yeah,
wouldn't it?
Yeah. It doesn't feel like it lied to you.
Mm.
I think that that's really important. It doesn't feel like, oh, you thought we were doing this.
Mm.
You thought we were going to zig, we're going to zag. Mm. Ha ha, aren't we smarter than you? It's just like, that was the little moment that we needed to see of Ivanova, and it sets up this day of hers.
Yes.
That's happening alongside of things.
Yeah, I do have minor issue, because it does feel like it's setting you up for this being from Ivanova's point of view, yet she's rarely in the story. But it doesn't matter as much, because what we do get is so fucking great or bizarre that you don't really care after a certain point that this wasn't actually about Ivanova.
Yeah, and this episode isn't one person's episode.
No, this
either.
Isn't like Infection, right? Where Infection was clearly a Franklin episode, then stolen by the B-plot or by Sinclair. This had a fun little opener with Ivanova, reminding us that our human characters are humans. I really like their exposition scene in which they were talking about like the raiders and like how they're striking all of these places. Even though it's a scene in which our characters are just talking business, I like them sitting down and talking business like this is their first thing in the morning. Like, okay, let's go over our reports.
This is our briefing.
The briefing scene. I don't know. I have a soft spot for that in B5 just because everything feels so lived in. Like, the characters having it have also this sense of being tired or not really wanting to talk about this, or we're having to talk about this because this is work. There's also, it's nice because it's reflected upon later in the episode in a way where after the big spaceship battles, we get back to business where Garibaldi's going over all of the casualties and losses and how the battle actually went, and we're getting the administrative side of the battle in a minor way. And you get that brief little moment where, you know, you find out one of our guys died, and I'll message family back home. But it is nice to see our characters have those administration things going on, because these characters are in part bureaucrats in a lot of ways. They're running a space station, and it's nice to actually see them running a space station instead of running a plot of the episode all of the time.
Well, we really have to discuss the beautiful, beautiful scene between Jakar and Londo.
At the elevator.
Yeah, at transport tube.
When you need one. Mm-hmm. I already pressed it. Well, I pressed it again. That scene, it's just perfect, isn't it?
Yes!
It works because we know that that's the dynamic those characters have.
We have to protect ourselves.
By doing to yourselves what you say we did to you. Ah, that's evolution for you.
Now see here.
Take the famine as a blessing, Ambassador. A weeding out of the excess population.
One more comment like that, Molari, and you will become part of the excess population.
Fire! Threat!
Yes, threat!
Now you can go to hell.
And you can kiss my pouch, you...
Now look what you made me do!
Peter Jurasik really sells it. He tees it up beautifully because he's already standing there. He's already given this look like, fuck, Jakar's here. And then he takes a moment, you know, after the back and forth about, I already pressed it. He takes a moment to just twist the knife in.
Like, he has the... you get the feeling that he wouldn't have done it if the doors had opened and they got in the elevator. He wouldn't have said anything. But he's like, I can't just leave silence. I've got it.
I'm Londo. I always want to talk.
Yeah.
And then he has his little jab about, like, I'm sorry to hear about the famine that's hidden your western frontier. My condolences. And he has, like, this hidden grin. Like, you can barely see it, but you can. There's this cheeky grin, and even the grin sound like transmits through his voice, this absolute two-faced condolence that he's giving. And Jakar, of course, snaps at it. And just to see those two, because they're very much the same character, right? That's what the scene even says, because we did this to you, now you're doing this to yourself so that you could do this to you. Ah, that's evolution for you. And of course...
And even them saying the same line.
Yes, and that's what caps it off, right? To really hammer in that these two guys, although hate each other, aren't that different to one another. You have the comedy zinger of them, yes, saying the line like, now look what you made me do, and they walk in completely different directions.
Yeah.
It's old school comedy, but Babylon 5... has old school sensibilities in lots of ways when it comes to his comedic stuff. Very Abbott and Costello, Rebo and Zooty. And so I love that. But Rachel, what makes the scene actually work? Who's the other person in the scene?
Oh, just the guy who's stuck in the middle.
The short, stout human man with a little hat.
Yeah, who escapes into the tube.
It is pure, like... fucking Marx Brothers comedy moment.
Londo hits him.
he kind of smacks him accidentally, but like, because he's so heated. That is,
like, you're on my side, right? And he's like, oh, no.
Yeah, like, he kind of just gestures that. Oh, man, that guy. And he doesn't have to say anything. And you know what I love about it? He, as soon as you see this guy, he's short, he's stout. He looks like he could fight me easily, but he has this real nervous energy already in the scene. Like, when the two of them rock up from one another, he has this intensity to him. Like, he's just so like, oh, this is gonna, like, you know, but he doesn't say anything, and then he just runs away. Casting there, guy doesn't say anything, but casting did a great job, because I think about that guy. I'm like, that guy did a great job.
So he's actor spotlight, right?
He's actor spotlight, of course. No one else. And of course... the battle scenes. How do you feel about the battle scenes? Now, we know the CGI is not up to snuff, but how do you feel about how Babylon 5 isn't afraid to actually just show you ships shooting?
Yeah, I really like it. And I was really, really enjoying it in this episode in particular. I feel like they got a really good pace and the music worked much better in the, like, over-the-topness that it was bringing.
We understood the geography of the fight, because yep. we understand the geography of the quadrant that Babylon 5 mm-hmm. is in. We know where the jump gate is. We know where yeah. Epsilon is. We know how big Babylon 5 is and what the ship's geography, like the station's geography itself. And they make sure to tell us it. They make sure to demonstrate yeah. it. Like, get them at the back so that we can trap them in there and blah, 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 and reduce damage to the station.
The logic within the editing also reaffirms that in clear ways and also more subtle ways, like the different angle setups
mm-hmm.
in each of the fighters and then back at Sinclair, and the way that like adjusts throughout the sequence.
Yeah, yeah. And the scene's coherent. The battle's coherent because we have been built up towards a battle in the story. We understand what the Raiders' goals are from them and from our crew. And we understand our station. We understand yeah. its abilities. We understand its defense network. We understand who's in the fight, who's staying on, who's the tactician, who's this and that. And, you know, Ivanova coming back there, she will be the cavalry that will come in and, you know, close it up. And then we have the knowledge of also the ship with the Kiro on it is heading here. Oh, we've missed it. All that could be really hard to follow, like it was in Star Trek Discovery's second season finale, where the iconic Yum Yum came from, where that had a very big space battle with several things happening at the same time. I mean, you didn't understand a fucking word of it. You couldn't follow any of it. Like, it was all nonsense. Here,
AI sausage, in fact.
AI sausage. Here, you can follow it and understand it, but it isn't the thrust of the episode. It is a part of the episode, but this isn't 45 minutes of CGI battles. Not just because they couldn't afford it, but because you have to tell a story.
Yeah.
Right? Isn't that right, Star Trek Discovery? You have to tell a story?
You know, yes, there's a tremendous amount of time and effort and, frankly, love put into all the CG work on the show. That is not where we start. The CG work on the show is there to support the emotional story, period.
Signs and Portents.
Yes.
That's the episode.
Mm-hmm.
So we should talk about the signs and the portents. I made a list of some of the interesting foreshadowing things, some of the interesting things that make you go, ah, on a rewatch. Some of the things that are just neat to look at and recognize when you're revisiting the show. And so one of the first ones I have written down is Mr. Morden comes onto the ship, our good friend Mr. Morden. And what's one of the first things he starts talking about? Do you remember when he rocks up on the station, he's at the gate?
Oh, he's been out on the rim. Needs made. Did you discover anything?
Did you find anything interesting?
Yes.
And we don't know what any of that means.
He just kind of snatches his card back and walks away.
With a smile.
And the dude's just like, well, whatever.
That's one of those ones where I remember, I think it was my third time watching it, where I really took in that line. Because when you watched it the first time, we don't know what the rim is. We don't really have an understanding of what that is. We don't know who this Mr. Morden guy is. We don't know why that line's just there, like, to be a line.
Yeah, it's just like, it makes it very clear where he was, he's been up to something.
And that he's been out of contact for quite some time. This card hasn't been used in a very long time.
Yeah.
Which ties into later when we find out where and what he's been up to and what he found on the rim, which was, of course, the shadows and, you know,
And his death.
Yeah, his fake death. And, of course, the death of Sheridan's wife, or not so much death. And, of course, you know, that's a part of the reworking of the story because of certain behind-the-scenes things. But that's how the story plays out in the end. That is just one of those moments in which you go, oh, that's neat.
Yeah.
But you know what sells it?
His delivery.
As always.
Yeah.
Great performance all around. Because he has this otherworldly smile and chipperness to it that there's something unsettling there. And even though we know what he found is giant space spiders, his line delivery gives you that reaction of, ooh, especially when you're rewatching it, you're like, oh, that's right. He found them on the rim.
Ripping with sleaze.
but not too much.
No, and not in a way where it makes you repulsed at the start. It just makes you uneasy.
You know that he's not right.
Yeah, and you get that feeling from like all of the ambassadors' interactions with him as well, of like he's weaseled his way into their lives.
He has influence of some sort. He has this otherworldly charm, and again, the performance is...
And it's not because he's a good guy that does good things.
He's a handsome man, but he's a naughty boy. That's one of those fun things. Of course, this plot has a MacGuffin, which is the eye. You know that cheap prop that they have?
That eye could make?
That little spinny and it's bizarre. You know, when you watch this episode that first time, you go, oh, yeah, the eye, yeah, it's a piece of jewelry. And, you know, then at the end you see, oh, they saved the eye. And now Londo owes a favor, I guess, for the eye. Oh, they'll call upon him. They'll meet him next time. Oh, you know, all that kind of stuff. And you just go, oh, well, that's interesting. You don't think the eye is important too much. Like, it's important in terms of it's the MacGuffin of the episode. And it's
only important because it's important to Londo.
Yes, and it's important to this entire Republic, right? But then, seasons later, we get a bunch of prophecies from Lashana Troi herself, in which one of her prophecies is about, you know, not giving away the eye, you know, not losing the eye. And that's, I've always taken it as this eye, because him giving the eye to Kiro led to the building blocks of his own destruction. You know, he gave the eye to someone who was clearly untrustworthy, someone who clearly represented the terrible values that Londo has within himself. Instead of being selfless and giving the eye over to someone else, he wanted the traditional nobility of give it over to the family and give it over to this nasty man. And it just...
He was following protocol even though he knew...
Mm-hmm.
That Kiro wasn't to be trusted.
Exactly. And
like, Kiro says to him, I shouldn't have it in my quarters, you keep it.
Yeah, and although it's unknowingly done this, it is a part of his fate that's sealed in a way, which one of the many building blocks
in
his destruction.
One of the many decisions and beliefs that contribute to him making that future for himself.
And it's tragic because he doesn't know that. You know, he just is oblivious, happy old Londo, and he's found this thing that's going to restore the Empire's, you know, restore the Republic's image and glory and give this sense of, you know, of morale to the people. And they say as much in the episode, like, the politics back home is decaying and becoming, you know, decadent, and the Emperor's no longer around. He's in, you know, he doesn't see the public eye, and the Prime Minister's running everything. We need a boost because everyone's depressed about the fact that we aren't this great empire anymore. Let's get this thing that represented when we were this great ruler of the universe. And Londo shouldn't be feeding that habit. He is unwittingly doing so. And that's what makes it fun when you rewatch it, is it's always been a part of his character since the gathering. But at this point in the story, it's been like a charming part of his character. Is that the right way to describe it? It's like, it's been a slightly like cute, endearing thing. Like, you look at it in this part of the story this early on, you go, oh, Londo's like a nostalgic man, and he's pining for
rascal.
The old days. Yeah, he's like a little rascal. Londo, my favorite little rascal.
You make very good sharks, Mr. Garibaldi. We were pretty good sharks ourselves once, but somehow along the way, we forgot how to bite.
Well, speaking of the eye, it gets dropped off by a finder of things. He's kind
of... Would you say he's an entrepreneur?
Yes.
Not a wanderer?
Oh, he wanders from here to there because he is essentially like a private detective sort of person.
Yes.
But he knows like the ins and outs and works outside the system.
Mm-hmm. He finds things and people and places.
Yeah.
He's a finder of things.
Yes. And That's basically what Garibaldi becomes.
Yeah, in season four, right?
We see that transition, and it's really neat when we get around to that, because we know that from this, in the back of our mind, we have that, oh yeah, that's a job that people do. People can be very successful in terms of wealth in doing that sort of job. And it makes sense that Garibaldi would move into that field.
And it's one of those, it's a touch here when, you know, the guy's saying these lines of dialogue that we see echoed three seasons from now with Garibaldi's transition away from being the chief of security. And it's like, oh, that's an interesting touch. It's not groundbreaking, you know, you can easily remove, you don't need it, and most people wouldn't even care about it. But it's one of those added layers to when you rewatch an episode like this that gives it
like,
so much more than it
really
actually has.
You were paying attention. Isn't that nice?
Yeah, and even if it isn't a deliberate thing, it's one of those, you know, echoes that you hear in later parts of the show. And that's nice. Mm-hmm. That's cute. That's really cool. And it was a cool thing that we noticed when we were watching it. It was like, oh, that's an interesting wrinkle and touch there. We're talking about all these foreshadowing things. I think the big one of the many big ones is the what do you want question, right? What do you want? When you watch this episode that first time.
Even like the little things that he does within the episode, like that question becomes so important. But we also are seeing the seeds for the gap between the shadows and the Vorns. And this is slightly off this topic, but when Morden hides from Kosh.
I love that. No, and it's not even hides, but lurks.
Yeah. Like, he's like, oh, what? And then the fact that he gets caught kind of in the end.
Yeah,
of
in
the
end. Yeah.
Like, Kosh seeks him out, and it's just like, no. And you don't get to see what happens.
No, and I
But you know that something went wrong because Kosh's encounter suit was damaged.
Yeah, if someone could take on the basic god of the ship, then what are those? Like, is Morden this weird individual? Like, is he magical? Is he an alien? Like, you didn't know when you first watched it. You didn't know that they had spider people next to him.
Yeah.
Which, you know, is an interesting little touch. Yeah, I love that he walks around with the what do you want question, because when you watch this episode the first time, that is what sticks with you is, remember that episode where that random mystery man walked up to every ambassador asking them, what do you want? And there's clearly an agenda behind it, but we don't know what it is until the end, in which it's like an intergalactic spider shoots a ship down and then delivers a thing to Londo because he gave the most fucking atrocious answer you could.
And we know that it isn't just his idea to do this, that he's doing somebody else's bidding.
He literally says, I'm not allowed to leave here until you answer my question. Like, I am unable to stop doing this, but
I am somebody else's puppet.
I'm a servant. I am, you know, I am an emissary, and I'm here to bestow this what do you want question. It drove me nuts watching it those first few times where it's like, what do you want? Why is this guy walking around saying, what do you want? How is this important at all? And you know when Londo gives his answer, you know it's important because of the reaction that Morden has, and then the ending of the episode with the shadows coming in, killing Kiro and giving the eye back. And you know it's important, but you don't know how it's important, and you've never met this guy. You don't understand anything because you didn't know that this was a show where ancient beings were going to be a part of it. You didn't know this was going to be a galactic-wide event like it is being introduced to be. You didn't think there's going to be an alien monster as the antagonist.
You got no clue.
And it throws you for a fucking loop. I found it exciting, though.
Yeah, I just wanted to know what the fuck was going on.
Like, when I saw the shadow ship and its legs appeared and it just lasered in half with a purple energy beam, oh man, that was so fucking cool. One, the ship design's awesome.
Oh, you were very cliche young boy about it, I imagine.
Of course, it was badass. You have
oh, that's fucking cool.
It was fucking cool. A Cthulhu-like ship came along and fucked that guy in the ass. It was great.
Our first introduction of the shadow vessels. I remember the audience reaction when I saw the post the next day after it aired was, what the hell was that?
When he goes to each one of them to get the what do you want, he doesn't go to Kosh. He gets rejected by Delenn. So you have Jukar and Londo. And both of them give very extreme answers. And both of them are very similar characters. And there's always that question, why didn't he choose Jukar? When you first watch it, you're like, why didn't he team up with Jukar? Jukar's the one with the more villainous answer. He wants to eradicate a whole race, you know, and delight in it. But you see in the acting from Morden that the answer wasn't ambitious enough. It was too small. He wanted revenge.
He didn't have an answer for then what.
Yeah, then what? I don't know. As long as my people's safety is guaranteed, then I don't think it matters. And it's just like, that's not good enough.
No.
We need people who have...
are blinded by what they want.
Yeah, and we need people with more ambition than just revenge. See, yeah. Londo doesn't want revenge in that simple form. He wants to make an empire.
And it's
he wants to
also
rectify and restore. But to do that, he wants to create something bigger than what is current.
Yeah. It's also because Londo's need doesn't have an end. It doesn't have something that it will be satisfied by. Because once they get to the point where they've returned Centauri Prime and they've reached out the hand and they've got those things, well, we've got to do better. We've got to stay stronger. We can do more. We can have more. And there's always going to be a need for more chaos.
Yes, and that's the thing is one of the thesis statements about power is, you know, wanting more power leads to more destruction, more chaos. And that is what the Shadow's whole ideology is, that we strive, we get better, we grow, we adapt, we get stronger
through conflict, chaos.
Destruction, the ambitions, the seeking of power, all of that stuff. And that's what Londo is. That's a part of what his character has within him. He's ignorant to the actual destructive cost of it because he looks at it with this nostalgic lens of, you know, these rose-tinted glasses of, the days in which we were the conquerors of it all and it was great, and doesn't actually recognize or understand the actual bloody cost of
which
that.
Which is so many people's view on colonialism.
That's the nature
of like,
of it.
Oh, you know, it wasn't that bad.
It was pretty bad. And,
you know, like, a lot of people would sort of, like, agree with Londo's statement in a non-hypothetical sense of, like, well, yeah, we strip mine your resources, but now you're doing it, so it's your fault that your environment's crapped its pants and there's a famine now.
Yeah, and one of the conversations he has with Kiro is, back in those days when we were in charge, we had a unifying thing to us. Now we don't, and everything is rupturing. Everything is coming apart. And the only way they see, as does the Shadows manipulating this, is to rectify the past and go back to those harmful ways. Instead of creating something new, they want to bestow something old, and those old things were bloody and violent. And one of the great things is, what's the first thing Londo says he wants?
To be left alone.
And he gets that too, in a way. He'll never be alone, but in the end, Londo's alone.
Oh, yeah.
He gets everything he wants in the worst of ways. The Centauri become a height of power, and then they fall really fucking quick.
But then there's ways that Jakar gets what he wants, too.
They all, in a way, get, in part, what they want in that manner.
Morden eventually does go away. That head is on a spike.
I mean, we don't get to hear what Veer wants yet, but he gets what he wants. Like, Jakar gets what he wants, but not in the way that he wants it. Like, he doesn't get the eradication of the Centauri. All he really wants, and this is what makes...
But they are defeated people.
But not eradicated, which is
not
what
eradicated.
But the essence of what he actually wants as a character, the thing that drives him to the end of the show is for the safety of his people,
yeah,
for his people's liberties, for his people's freedom, for his people's rights. And eventually that, you know, happens or spirals out of control, but eventually he's always fighting for that. Here he's blind by hatred, where he thinks the only way to do that is through extreme violence and war, but he learns. Londo takes too long to learn. And that is what damns him in the end. And that's what's so great. When you watch this and Londo's given that big ass speech, it's delivered so well by Peter Jurasik, because he's spitting this venom out and he's got this rhythm to it where it makes it feel so natural. Because if this was in anyone's hands, any other person's hands, they could easily drop this where it feels really artificial or forced. Like, now
this is my monologue.
Yeah, this is my angry speech.
This is my moment on this is my screen.
Moment.
You really want to know what I want? You really want to know the truth? I want my people to reclaim their rightful place in the galaxy. I want to see the Centauri stretch forth their hand again and command the stars. I want a rebirth of glory, a renaissance of power. I want to stop running through my life like a man late for an appointment, afraid to look back or to look forward. I want us to be what we used to be. I want it all back the way that it was. Does that answer your question?
We get introduced to the Chrysalis device being built. This is, I think, the first episode that we've seen it being built in the season. It's going to be continuously being built. And that's one of those things, right, where you lose your mind when at the end of the season it's actually meaning something, because you just think, oh, it's just a
puzzle?
It's just a fun physical motion for the actor to do in scenes when they're just talking instead of just sitting down and doing nothing. Like, oh, Delenn's doing a puzzle, I guess. Or she's making a model. Or
it is sort of a puzzle because she has to figure out
how it works. Yeah, but you don't know that this funky puzzle is going to be one of the most important devices in the show.
Oh, boy.
For her and Sinclair.
You have no clue.
But when you rewatch it,
and I love that I have no clue, because so many times when shows do something like that, they just hold too long on the thing.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, that's going to be a check of something.
Yeah, yeah. And the final thing to mention, I think, of a big note, you know, we have all the shadow stuff is introduced, but, you know, as much as we don't like Lady Ladira, she has her prophecy about the ship being exploded. Mm-hmm. I've always loved how this monologue she gives at the end is Babylon 5 looking you in the eye and explaining to you how prophecies work in this show, which is basically...
Oh, I love the way that she explains it as well, because, like, there's such an interesting debate to be had, whether you pick a side or not, between determinism and free will. And I really like where this lands.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's done well, because earlier in the show we've been presented with Londo and his ability to see the future, and he sets it in stone.
He's yes.
Like, this will happen. And then we get introduced to somebody who says, things are flexible. But I see this is a grand possibility, but we can work mm-hmm. towards it. It's a way of saying, this is a possibility that will happen in the show, but maybe it won't be.
Yeah.
And it's satisfying to hear how this show says how prophecy and time stuff works, in which this speech makes all the Babylon 4 stuff and the explosion of Babylon 5 and all that work, because it's letting us know this will happen, but not in the way you think.
Yes. But also the importance of people's beliefs in whether something will happen or not. Because part of Londo's fate is that he believes that that endpoint is set.
And then there comes a point where there comes a point where he burns the bridges to the point in which there is only one outcome.
Yeah.
And
He gets stuck,
and Sinclair has the choices and the abilities ahead of him. And of course, things work in a certain way for that character. It's just brilliant that this episode, there's that shot that he sees of Babylon 5 exploding. And you can't help but think about that's like the final Babylon 5 shot in the show when Babylon 5's exploding. It's a very similar shot. I don't think it's exactly one-to-one, but it's a very similar shot. And a part of her vision she's seeing is, I do believe, is what happens to Babylon 5 if Babylon 4 didn't go back in time. And the events of that, I do believe. But the most important thing is that that image of Babylon 5 exploding, image-wise, sticks with you as an audience because it's the first time we're presented with that image.
Always there. And you have that kind of, I don't know, sort of fear in the back of your mind of, like, each season finale, is that going to happen?
When's that going to happen?
Have they avoided that? Is that still the path that they're on?
Yeah, and it's so satisfying to, when you come back to this episode, to know how the dominoes fall and that this makes sense.
The future is always changing. We create the future with our words, our deeds, and with our beliefs. This is a possible future, Commander. And it is my hope that you may yet avoid it.
This episode is paying off stories or furthering stories that we've previously introduced. This episode is telling a story currently. And this episode is setting up and introducing new future things to see down the line of the show. But Rachel, how does this episode still manage to be something that one can comprehend? Because that's a lot to lay on the table. And we've seen many TV shows, like we have covered in the past with Star Trek Discovery, where you have episodes like this and you revisit them and they feel weird, or you're watching them that first time and they're just basically incomprehensible, or you just watch it and it has always been just like, this is an overload, like, it just doesn't work, this is messy. How is this episode still something one can comprehend?
Hear me out. I know that this is something that I don't think we've broached before. They had a plan.
Whoa.
They had a plan from beginning to end. So everything is there for a reason. It has its own logical sense in the long run and very clear purpose in the short term.
Yeah.
And we understand the world as well as the internal world of all of our characters.
That's what I think is the most important. I think what makes this episode work is it's great to have all the shadow stuff. It's great to have Morden here. It's great to have all that. But you need to understand your characters.
We get a Voniver.
You need to understand have the characters consistent on the on the reevaluation of the episode. Because as stated, we're getting all this Sinclair stuff, all of this Londa Jakar stuff that's being reintroduced into the show, like being re-put into the show, like we've seen it, and it makes sense. It's like, that's logical. That is something we've seen before. Londo's anger and Jakar's anger and Sinclair's past being a mystery and Garibaldi being the best friend and Ivanova being the pessimist. And we've seen it all before, but it makes sense. We go, okay, that's something I recognize. And those things that you recognize can still be something that will guide you along in a new story of an episode if they are consistent with what we've seen. They are. And then when it's something in terms of how this is setting up all of these new things, it works because Londo's speech that damns him in the end makes sense coming from him at this point in the story. And also when you end the show, that is a point of view that character held for a very long time.
Yep.
It's not as if it just suddenly goes away. It's something that was always in a part of his character. And same with all of them, like we said with Jakar. He just wants his people's liberties and freedom. Here in the story, he's angry and bitter and rage-filled. That makes sense for this part of the story. So it's coherent when you watch it the first time round.
Yeah. Jakar wants to be out of the shadow of the Centauri and for his people to be standing on their own. And he can only see that happening by them casting a bigger shadow than the Centauri.
He has a very small and immature way of looking at how to, you know, help his people.
Yeah.
And we will see in the show him go through so many massive taxing events to help him learn that there's a different way of thinking. And so what makes an episode like this that has all of those things of paying off stuff, still being an episode on its own, like you just tuned in this week, this episode still has to make fucking sense story-wise, and one where you look back on it and say it introduced all this stuff, what guides it along in many ways, there's many things, but the big one is the character's internal workings. Sinclair makes sense in the story. Hearing about how the Minbari chose him and how that brings him anxiety and how all of that, it makes sense because Sinclair, emotionally in the episode, is actually going through something about that.
And that would not be sold if the actors weren't doing a good job.
No, no. And again, if the writing wasn't hitting the notes correctly of these characters, if Sinclair was angry about this in this episode, I don't think it would make sense. That wouldn't make sense for him. Or as we've said, his arc is continuing. In this episode, he does not go out and do the space battles. Mm-hmm. He is sitting in CNC and he's looking through documents and records and he's doing the admin. Yes, he's learning that to be a good leader, he needs to be a leader, not the cowboy, not the renegade, not the fighter.
He needs to be a commander.
He needs to actually do his fucking job. Yes. And he's been doing that. And like, again, it's represented here.
He's not the leader of a fighter squadron anymore.
Yeah, and it's a...
He's a leader in a very different type of position.
Babylon Control to Delta Wing. Do you copy, Delta Leader?
Confirm, Babylon Control.
What's your status?
We just got word the Raiders have broken off the attack. We're flying in pursuit.
Negative, Delta Leader. Do not pursue.
Repeat, do not pursue. Return to base.
But Commander...
It's a diversion, Lieutenant Commander. They want your force as far from the station as possible. Return to base at once.
Confirm Babylon Control.
Morden. I know we're not doing an actor spotlight.
That sleazy ball.
We're not doing an actor spotlight on that guy because he'll be someone we can talk about over the many episodes of discussion. But this performance makes the Londo side so much more beefy than it actually feels like it is in the script. He's very charming, devilish, esoteric. Nature is so well turned.
Just the right amount of him in this episode for me.
Oh, and it's funny.
Yeah.
Morden's funny. Like,
when he jumps in the lift.
And he has that smile on his face.
Like, oh, you're not getting rid of me.
Yeah, that performance, especially in this episode, rides that line so well of being mysterious in a genuinely enthralling way and mysterious in an annoying way because he is annoying.
Oh, no question there.
But in a way where I lean forward in my seat and go, but I want to figure you out. What's your deal? Why are you annoying Londo?
Fascinating.
Are you a human? Or are you a god or a ghost? What's your deal?
I thought the vicar was human, but nope.
No, and the writing, of course, is important, but you need the right performer for this type of role. And he delivers it, like we said, absolute slime. Mm-hmm. You look at him and go, of course this guy's evil.
He is a slime ball.
But you can't figure out what kind of slime he is. You go, what are you... Every time... Here's how I describe...
Like when Jakar was a slime ball, you knew it.
You knew what kind he was. You knew
You're
his
like,
motivations.
You're like, that's my garden variety...
Slime ball.
He,
in this one, though, he's like a magic eye, you know, picture, poster. You're like... You have to get the right angle to get an image. You have to look at him right to get...
He's an optical illusion of sorts.
Yeah, at this point in the show, we will learn more and it'll become crystal clear, but, you know, he's enticing. He reminds me of a... He reminds me of a car salesman.
Yeah.
Where you know you're being played, but you have to play the game.
And you know that the only way is through.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, the only way to get rid of Morden is to answer his question. So you just have to go through the process of having the conversation, whether you want to or not.
Last thing I want to talk about before we get to our actor spotlight is this introduces the big bad, the shadows.
Yeah.
What was your thought on the fact that this show had a big villain introduced to it? Because that's when you watch it, you clearly know what that is. You're like, even if you don't know the details, you look at that thing and go, oh, that's going to be the big bad guy.
Yeah, I thought it was just going to be wrapped up at the end of the season.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I'm used to the Buffy way of doing things. If, mm-hmm. like, you have the little bad each episode.
The big bad each season.
And then the big bad gets dealt with in the season finale, and then there's another big bad.
And sometimes the big bad comes back a season or two later as a goodie. Spike.
Yeah. Yeah, but I just thought it was going to be a rinse repeat, because all you told me was it gets answered. And that was the structure that I was used to.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to think about it, huh?
So when I was like,
structure from this era of TV.
Yeah.
Because you saw this in like 2014. Mm-hmm. And so by then, this style of story was standard fare. We were watching Game of Thrones at the time. You know, mm-hmm. all of that was standard fare. But yeah, I always thought that they were going to be a factor in it. But I guess, silly old me, I didn't think that they were going to be as big as they were until season two.
Mm.
Because I was like, well, Earth is going to be the big thing. They kill the president at the end. Like, Earth is And in the end, Earth is kind of the final foe in a lot of ways. But the shadows linger.
The force.
But I liked that there was a big bad, because I was used to Star Trek, in especially TNG, in which they had big bads, but they weren't actually there. Like, the Borg show up every now and then. The Romulans show
the
up every now and then.
Ever present. And you...
They actually do stuff.
Get to the point where you are always questioning if there is a shadow connection, if we can figure out the possibility of one.
Have we seen stuff that's already related to them?
And are we going to get concrete connections? Because this web that they've created just keeps building and building.
And there's something thrilling about a foe in a sci-fi show like this that actually strikes. The first thing we see them do is strike. We see them just attack and massacre. In other shows, it's like hinting, ooh, ooh, ooh. We didn't have any real hints that we knew of when we first watched it. We just saw that and they struck, and they let you know that these guys aren't going to fuck around.
And they could have done that, because I'm pretty sure Delenn says at some point, like, we know that they've been building up for a really long time, working in the background.
Why are they waiting when they could easily just strike?
Of things. And the show could have decided to focus on that. But no, we enter the story at this point.
You are a very persistent young man.
I have to be. I'm not allowed to leave here until you've answered my question. What do you want?
This is a silly conversation.
Yes, it is. What do you want?
To be left alone.
I think we gotta get to the actor of discussion in the part of the show in which we talk about an actor or actress that appeared, talk about what we've seen them in, what we thought about their performance in this episode. Rachel, we're talking about Lord Kiro, mm-hmm. of course, whose name is...
Garrett Graham.
Garrett Graham.
He currently has 127 credits on IMDb.
Yeah, he's a big character actor. Yes. He's in a fuck ton of shit. Not currently working, though.
No.
He's kind of retired from the scene of film and TV.
Last credit was 2012.
Yes, yeah, so almost 10 years without this guy's crazy performances.
So he was born in 1949 in New York.
Mm-hmm.
He had his debut on stage at 8 in our production of Winnie the Pooh.
Was he Winnie?
The bio didn't say.
Who do you think he was? I have my guess.
I would assume Christopher Robin.
Really? I think he's Eeyore.
Okay.
Oh. Do you see this guy's eyes? He's Eeyore. Yeah. Definitely. Are you kidding me? No, he's Tigger.
His first credit was in 1968, so he was 19.
Mm-hmm.
In Greetings!
Greetings! Good evening to you.
As Lloyd Clay.
One of his early credits, which I think is the most important, is Phantom of the Paradise, which is a Brian De Palma film. Great film if you're looking for something to add to your musical list or your October list. Phantom of the Paradise is really good. And I think JMS likes Phantom of the Paradise because he gets one or two cast members from that to do guest roles. That also has the guy in it whose name I'm forgetting off the top of my head. The guy who wrote Rainbow Connection. That guy, forgetting his name off the top of my head, but he has him later in season 2 of Babylon 5 as the translator guy for that alien race that wants to fuck Ivanova.
Oh, yeah!
Yeah, Paul Williams. And so, you know, this actor was in Phantom of the Paradise, which is a big cult movie, and of course JMS likes it, so he chucks in some actors in there, and he's weird in that, and he's weird here in Babylon 5. He does a weird performance.
Of course. He's a weird guy. He was in The Twilight Zone.
Who isn't, honestly? I mean, he's in a
He was also a voice in the Critic.
Yes, that's the most important thing. So in the Jay Sherman show, which, you know, some people may not have seen The Critic, but Jay Sherman, the film critic in The Simpsons, he was in a few episodes voiced by John Lovitz. He's the voice of Jay Sherman's adopted father, and he's like a rich, crazy old man, and he's probably the best character the entire show.
As the first black female head of the Ku Klux Klan, I'd like to say America stinks.
He has so many wacky things, and when I was first watching Babylon 5, I looked this guy up because I was always curious of actors, and I saw he was in The Critic, which I had not seen at the time.
Yeah.
And I forgot about that. And then I watched The Critic, and I was like, oh, I love this dad guy. Who's this guy? And then I looked it up, and he's like, oh, he's in Babylon 5? Oh, my brain broke because, you know, penguins can't fly.
This actor has lots of fun credits.
Have you seen him in anything?
I've seen him in random things, and I believe that you have a few ones that you want to bring up that we've watched together.
But anything to you that you've seen him in?
And oh,
you
My remember? Girl too.
Do you remember him in it?
No.
No?
He's a character actor.
Of course. Well, he was in Chopping Mall. I want to highlight Chopping Mall, the iconic Chopping Mall. It would be, he was in Police Academy 6, which I think is the last Police Academy. But he's in Star Trek. Of course he's in Star Trek. And to me, he's in probably one of the best Q episodes of all time to me. Which is the Voyager episode in which a member of the Q Continuum wants to die.
Yeah.
And he is that member of the Q Continuum. He's Quinn. And he gives one of my favorite performances in Star Trek Voyager, like guest performances.
Yeah.
He's one of the few Q character, like, actors that doesn't try to emulate John DeLancey.
Yes.
As well. Like, a lot of the Q actors try to emulate DeLancey, and he doesn't necessarily. He brings his own flavor to it. It's just a great episode of TV, and it's one of those episodes that I highlight as why Voyager could be a good show. And it was just a great episode, and He's great in it, and I love him in that. And, you know, like I said, The Critic and a few other things, but that's the big one, right? Voyager is the big one. He's in Deep Space Nine. I don't remember him in Deep Space Nine, but I remember him in Voyager. He gets a lot to do, and that's where my damning criticism is for this episode. The first season suffers, like we said. You bring in these character actors, and you give them stuff to do, and it's just not satisfying enough. He gets to do the stuff that I expect this actor to do, but Voyager gave him an actual role to play. This was, you got to see him do some weird line deliveries, which was fun, and do some wacky hand gestures. But he's wasted here. I would have loved to have seen this guy play a different role in B5 where you actually give him time. Here, he's just, He's got no time. And when he does have time, he's just spouting a lot of, like we said, exposition.
Yeah.
Lots of telling. He doesn't really get to sink his teeth into much. And it's a big stain on the first season of Babylon 5 is you get these character actors that have unique abilities as performers and you just don't use them to their best abilities. It's really unfortunate. And that's what I think of him in this. It's that age-old problem of the first season. What about you? What did you actually think of him?
Yeah, I thought he was working hard. You got that sense of, like, he's really trying to bring it. And there's not enough there for him to really do what he's trying to do. Because there isn't time to create the depth that the performer is trying to bring to it. So some of it just feels a bit overwrought because of that. Because you get the sense that, like, he's done a lot of character work with the idea and the script and trying to embody Lord Kiro.
And he has that look, right? He has this very distinct look physically, these eyes, this face, and he looks like a guy who would nail this character. Like, he looks like this rich, pompous weirdo with ambitions higher than they actually can achieve.
Maybe and that sense of entitlement.
And not to discredit the actor who does play this character, but maybe this guy would have been great as Reefer.
Yeah, maybe.
The guy who plays Reefer, I think, is actually what pretty decent. But, like, this guy, I wonder if it's one of those things where JMS looks back and goes, man, I wish I kept this guy in my back pocket.
The eye belongs to my family, my house. Why should I give it to the Emperor?
We must all make our sacrifices.
If I were to return with the Eye and claim the throne for myself.
Lord Kiro, please, I understand your feelings. You could do what you describe, but without support, you would be dead within a day of trying.
I think we've covered a lot of ground in our discussion of science importance. There's so much more it feels like. It's a big, beefy, juicy, wonderful episode. But what would you rate it?
Yum yum.
Yum yum.
It's a yum yum.
Yum yum.
This episode gets you thinking in a way about the writing of the show and how it's structured in the grand scheme of things. Not in the same way where Believers got you thinking about the writing of the actual themes of the episode. This gets you thinking about the show as a whole.
Yeah, it's like, this makes you think about the machine rather than the cogs.
Yeah, that's a great way to describe it, but it's definitely yum yum.
Yum yum.
I think we need to hear about what we'll be covering next week.
On the next Babylon 5.
Oh boy. Some people say it's not that bad. Some people say it's the worst episode ever.
It's not.
And it is TKO.
Total knockout.
Yes.
No, technical knockout, so. Mm-hmm. All right, TKO, I think...
No rounds. Oh, what? You wanted to say something?
Oh, I was going to say, I think everyone knows this episode. It's memorably bad, but let's hear what the DVD description has to give off.
Which I will also say, I think it is memorable on its own.
No rounds, no rules, no gloves. To these decrees, Alien follows of the brutal fighting of Mutai and another no humans.
What?
But a determined boxer from Earth, Greg McKinney, aims to knock that edict flat.
Yes. Okay.
Plus
what?
Plus a rabbi.
What, is he in the fight? Is the rabbi a fighter? Is he training?
No.
I'm sure this really connects with this plot.
Theodore Bakel guides a Vonnegut in a long overdue ritual of Shiva.
Oh, that sounds like those two plots really run smoothly together and deserve to be in the same episode, and sounds like the B plot should not at all be the B plot, but okay.
It...
It's TKO.
It's a true melding.
The real TKO was the friends we made along the way. Rachel, a pleasure talking Babylon 5 with you. Mm-hmm. Where can people follow us on the internet?
They can find us on various social media platforms by searching Yum Yum Pod or Yum Yum Podcast. But if they check out that description, they can find those direct links to our Instagram, Facebook, Reddit, Tumblr, Twitter, TikTok.
Yeah.
Did I not say
Twitter? I said it again, just in case you didn't say it. I was too busy thinking about our posts. And how we post stuff on those social medias that are really fun and you should engage with them.
You know what's even more fun?
What?
People giving us money for extra content.
Oh, yes, we make extra content for money that you can throw our way to support the show. We have our Patreon in which we talk about movies, we talk about other TV shows, and we are going through the best and worst rated episodes of Star Trek. If you're at all interested in that, head on over to Yum Yum Podcast on Patreon. If you want to email us with your thoughts, questions, queries, concerns, general stuff, you can hit us up on the email yumyumpod@gmail.com. All of this is in the description as stated. Rachel, what do you want?
Kiss my pouch.
Ah, Mr. Cannibal, there.